Accession number 21552, Mule 2.
Raymond Venables, Reel 2. You'd arrived at Tor Point. Were you issued with your kit there?
Yeah.
What did that consist of?
Well, the usual sort of bell-bottom trousers and a funny little hat, which is difficult to keep on the top, and the traditional rig of an ordinary seaman.
Who was in charge of the recruits?
In charge of?
The recruits at that stage.
We were most aware of a divisional officer who was the immediate boss of our division. And, of course, the petty officers, who tended to treat you rather badly, at least orally.
How would that manifest itself?
Well, they sort of screamed at you as you did drill, and there was still a notion that, the best way to train men is to bark at them, even in the Navy. It wasn't nearly as bad as in the Army, where, sergeant majors who scream from the other end are quite famous and appear from time to time in the correspondence columns of the Times, I notice. But it was not a thing that I admired. I don't think leadership is to do with behaving rather like a shit, which is, I can remember one or two people that I remember with persistent dislike because they had this belief, but some others who were lovely and nice West countrymen for the most part, and they were nice and were father figures to us. It was a mixture.
Do you find with those types who they'd had an awful lot of service time in?
Awful lot of
service time.
Yes, they were pretty senior. Yes.
So you'd arrived there. Were you given your first meal?
I can't remember the first one. I can remember that they were pretty bad and pretty inadequate. My chief memory there is that I was always hungry, and so my two brothers, who were not in the forces, one was a reserved occupation, the other was a Spitfire pilot afterwards, but they established what was called the sinking fund, and they sent their little brother some money from time to time. What sunk was the bottom of my stomach, and I used to go into the canteen at Standeasy and buy about 8 doughnuts and eat them. I was so hungry. It was cold. That winter was desperate. 41. And after marching up and down, so I was always hungry. We were not fed very plentifully, is my memory.
What type of rations would you be given?
Well, it was the ordinary food, but I remember once, for example, there was we were offered sheep's hearts, and I couldn't face sheep's hearts, nor could anybody else. They all got tipped into the gas bin at the end. My only memory of the food was that it was awful.
So you mentioned you'd done some drill. How did that progress? What was your first experience of drill?
Well, I've always found it, and of course the naval attitude to drill is mercifully different from the Army. I mean, they never take it very seriously. Because if you've got to operate a ship, a warship, in battle, what you learn in drill isn't really very useful. I remember once in my first weeks there, I was sitting, I had some time off, I was sitting above the parade ground, and I looked down and I saw these sailors marching up and down, and I thought, I had a great sense of the unreality of it. I remember thinking to myself, having recently been a student, this, what I'm watching, is much more unreal than Hamlet. That there's some truth in Hamlet, but there's no truth in that. It's absurd. I never quite lost this feeling.
Was that just the kind of abstract nature of the environment that you found yourself in?
Well, no, it was the actual business of thinking that the best way to train men is to march them up and down. I mean, for Obviously, in the First World War, when you've just got to tell people to go over the top and get themselves butchered, then total not thinking but doing as you were told on the spot is important. But in the Second World War, it was very different, and certainly it was different in the Navy, and the Navy knew it. They didn't pay too much attention to squad drill.
So you don't think it was beneficial for some recruits?
I doubt it. I very much doubt it.
What other forms of training were you involved in those first few weeks?
Well, basic seamanship, tying knots, studying your seamanship manual, which I regret that I've lost. It's a remarkable document, and the old one. A bit of gunnery, a bit of this and a bit of the other. It was all pretty basic.
How did you go about tying the knots? Were you...
I wasn't particularly good at it. The one I can still do rather well, because it's rather important, is if they chuck you a rope, you need, in the if you're in the water, you tie it round yourself and you do a bowline on the bight. I can do a bowline on the bight to this day, because your life might depend on it.
So the instruction with knots, they would say that are various knots for various activities.
Yeah. You had to do a sheep shank. But I couldn't do a sheep shank now. And a round turn and 2 half-hitches, I can remember.
What other things were in the seaman's manual that you were...
You mucked about a bit in boats, and you learnt the parts of a boat. It starts off with the parts of a hammock, the clues, I can remember. And you learnt how to sling a hammock, because you slept in one for the next few years.
Did you sleep in them while you were at Talbot?
No, they had bunks there.
So you were instructed on how to sling a hammock?
Sort of, yes.
Is there a drill for learning that sort of thing that they instil into you in those early training?
No, the drill is in the gunnery. You get a gunnery drill, which, again, is slightly comic. Someone moving at the double removes the tampion thing in the hand, but the chap who is moving with the cordite doesn't move at the double because he might drop it and things like that. You do all sorts of basic gun drill of that kind. Learn about the gun.
Did you have any weapons training at all?
I'm afraid we had some bayonet drill, which, again, I found utterly unbelievable. The object of bayonet training is to instill the instinct to kill. And, none of us appreciated that very much.
What would the training consist of?
Well, you charged at things and at a sort of stuffed sack and stuck a bayonet in it. 4 inches is quite enough, you would be told.
Were you... meant to be as warlike as possible?
That's right, they tried to make you bloody-minded and warlike, yes.
How long was this period of basic training going on for?
I suppose about 8 weeks, as far as I remember.
And you mentioned gunnery and knots and some seamanship.
Yeah, the main thing was when the ice melted... And suddenly somebody says, anybody play rugby around here? And my life changed, because, nobody can tell you what to do on a rugby field. You go and do your thing. And it also, my division officer was a mad keen, he trained us in the rugby. He's the only rugby coach I've ever known who, when he went down in the scrum, went on his back under the scrum to adjust what people were doing. And after that, I'm afraid he used to be inspecting us, and he'd say, do your tape, don't you? Oh, did you enjoy the game, Metamorphs? I got a lot of stick from it. But I played for the whole establishment, and we had started a sort of a bit of a thing in naval rugby, which I loved. And suddenly... life seemed to me totally different.
Would you say then that sport plays an important role in the services?
Yes, I did. To those who loved it, it made a huge difference. Because I say, doing something without being told what to do, you're not under discipline. And the rugby was the naval thing. I mean, soccer was stronger in the army. And there was also a sort of officer rating thing that the officers played rugby and the ratings played soccer. Officers played hockey. I played hockey for my cruiser, and you know, I was the only ordinary seaman playing.
Would that have been? You mentioned it was noticeable amongst your fellow recruits.
Mm.
Would the officers have noticed you for all that?
Yes, they did. Yes.
How did you get on with them when you were playing rugby?
What, the
officers?
Well, better, because they said they had a certain respect for you, which they hadn't got before.
So, how did that period come to an end?
Well, you sort of passed out from that. And you were still an ordinary seaman, and then you went off to... I went to a sort of barracks in Plymouth, waiting to be appointed to a ship.
Plymouth at that time had suffered some German bombing.
It did. We went, when we arrived there, and I was there for a bit, and then we went on leave, and my leave coincided with the worst week's bombing of Plymouth. So when we went back, we were divided into two sorts of working parties. You either went looking for bodies, or you went looking for safes under the commercial buildings, because there were all these businessmen who had all their bills and things in the safes, and they needed their safes back. Fortunately, I wasn't on bodies, I was on safes. And we went round sometime, and it amused me at that time to notice the slight difference between the Navy and the Army, because you had to pull whole walls down to make it safe to get in there. And the Army's method was to take a Bren carrier and put a line around it, or a tank, you go and put it down, whereas the typical West Country petty officer, we used to use a thing called a Western Purchase. A Western Purchase is a kind of series of pulleys, but not in with rope, but with chain, and they're very strong. And we used to put on a Western Purchase and just do a few pulls, and the whole thing would fall down. But we actually went into Dartmoor Prison at one point, because they moved a lot of stores out of Plymouth a bit late. But we were in Dartmoor Prison, and I well remember working our fingers to the bone, carrying crates about, while the prisoners were walking around taking their exercise in the sun. We wondered whether this world was quite fair.
What was the state of Plymouth generally?
Well, when we went back, it was almost unrecognisable. It was desperately bombed and in a great mess.
Had there been many naval casualties during the bombing?
You know, I don't know whether they had. I don't think they had. I think it was mostly in the town.
So you were involved in that while you were in barracks?
Yes, but the actual bombing, not. I mean, I just happened to be away for the week when it mostly happened. So I saw the aftermath of it.
And how had you spent your leave?
Oh, seeing my girl, and my mother, and my grandfather. I can't always distinguish which leave from which, but sometimes it was in my grandfather lived in Rutland, which is just about as rural as you can get in a cottage, and somehow that always seemed the biggest contrast with what I was normally doing. I also used to take him, slightly illegally, he smoked a pipe, so I used to take him you know, half a pound of naval issue tobacco and kept him going through the entire war.
What was travel like on the trains at that time?
Awful, but interesting. You always talked to people, but you stopped in tunnels and it took ages, and but it was that mixture. I did one journey from Falmouth to Thurso, if you could think of that, and that was extraordinary. We slung our hammocks in the train, slept in our hammocks. But the journeys were, they cut both ways. They were, you did meet most fascinating people and you talked to them.
Did they take a long time, the journeys? Were they longer because...
Oh, yes, they were much longer, yes. My wife was a Wren in Lowestoft, and getting yourself to Lowestoft in those days was a very slow business.
So, what happened after Plymouth?
After Plymouth, I got appointed to the Edinburgh. I got sent to the Edinburgh.
How did that come about?
Well, I don't know. That was the feeling you had. They just put you into a transport and off you went. You know, the chief difference about that, I mean, I'm not going to deny that it was a good thing to get to be an officer. And the chief reason was that when you're an officer, you take some decisions and you know in advance what is going to happen. As an ordinary seaman, you just get told and pushed. The ship is steaming one way, full speed, and then it turns round and it's going the other direction, and nobody tells you why. And you think, well, why the hell are we doing this? Whereas if you're an officer, you put it on the chart first, and so you know.
So where did you join Edinburgh?
I joined her right up in Scapa.
How did you get to Scapa?
Well, we by train. That was the one from down in Plymouth to... Yes, it was not Falmouth. It was Plymouth to Thurso, and then in a boat from there to Scapa.
How long do you think that took?
Oh, it took us hours and hours. One chap I knew quite well, who was an ordinary seaman with me, and later we spent some time officer training together. But his family lived on the line up in Scotland somewhere, and he spent the whole journey telling us what his dear family were putting into a hamper for us. The booze and the meat and so on. And we came to this station, and at very slow speed, we steamed straight through it without stopping. And there we looked at the platform, and there was his family waving, but it was a great hamper, but we never got to see it.
What was Scapa Flow like?
That was terrible. Because one thing, once you were there, it was extremely difficult to get any leave. I mean, we were based in Scapa in the Edinburgh for some months, and I only went on leave once, and that meant you got into a kind of trawler and went to one of the islands, and they gave you a ticket which entitled you to 2 pints of beer. There was no money changed hands, and you went into this place and you came back in the trawler, and absolutely everybody was absolutely drunk. And that was a run ashore, and one did much better to stay on board.
Was that a civilian establishment, or was it a naval?
Yeah, it must have been naval.
Mm. And what was Scapa itself like? What were your impressions of it?
Well, lots of big ships, you know, but, you know, boring and cold, and, you know, you don't often get good weather up there, and we certainly didn't.
What was Edinburgh like as a ship? Can you describe it?
Well, describe her physically, you can just go and look at the Belfast, which is a sister ship. It was not a particularly happy ship because it had commissioned before the war started and had never had much leave. So at that time it had a rather old senior captain who didn't actually, was not much admired by some of the other officers, and the ship's company were pretty bloody minded, who can blame them?
Had she been in the whole fleet for all that period since her
commission? Yes, I think so, yes.
And when had you actually joined? What month was it roughly?
I could tell by looking at a piece of paper, but I can't remember exactly. It must have been in the summer of 1941, I think.
On board, obviously there's a hierarchy with a ship. Could you describe that to me, how it is on a cruiser? Who would do what and how the branches of the
various... Well, all I can tell you is that what was called an HOOD, hostilities only thing, was the absolute bottom end. And you were told this pretty vigorously the entire time. And if you were a rookie, there wasn't a lot of kindness showed you by your more experienced fellow sailors. It was a slight problem if you pronounced your H's. There was a sort of class thing, a bit, and it could be difficult. What I found you did was that you... not that you dropped your H's, but you soon adopted the language used by your fellow sailors. And I used expletives, which I've never used before or since. On the grounds, I mean, being trained as a modern linguist, you go and speak the local language. But it was not always pretty, but it was... it got better. It got better when somebody, you start off by not saying anything. Then if you turn round and say, "Hey, mate, cut that out," then it gets better.
So you were an ordinary seaman. What particular branch were you involved in?
Well, just general seamanship. The only special job when you were a loading number on a gun, a 4-inch anti-aircraft gun. I was a help to extraordinary business. We had an old seaplane, Walrus, was it called? We had a Walrus, and it catapulted across the deck like this. And I was a handling party on this, so I had to hang on to a rope and let go when I was told to. And I never forget this thing. It revved up and roared away and then roared across the catapult and sank. It nearly hit the water and then off it went again. And when it came back, it was quite skillful because the cruiser had to... It steamed along, and as the thing came into land, it altered course abruptly to create a smoother bit of water where it could land, and then you hoisted it in. But it was all a pretty shaky business.
And within the ship, you mentioned the captain. Would he have overall command of the vessel?
Yes. He also carried an admiral, who, of course, was not in... He was in command of some of the other ships when we went to Malta and Malta convoys. Admiral Seyfried, he was a South African, which became important to us because we went down to Cape Town and he decided that his ship's company all needed some leave, so he got us all put up 48 hours leave by the good citizens of Cape Town.
And You mentioned there was a distinction about you being hostilities only. Were the majority of the ship's crew at that time hostilities only, or were they regulars?
I can't tell you whether a majority was, but since the ship had been in commission since before the war started, an awful lot were regulars.
And obviously you said you were in a fairly lowly position.
Yeah.
What was the chain of command from yourself upwards?
Well, there was a leading hand of your mess, leading seaman of your mess, and then there'd be a petty officer, and you didn't really see much of the officers. It was mostly the petty officers who, because you spent an awful lot of your time, of course, cleaning the ship and painting it. That was really your chief activity, and you always did that with... I hardly ever met an officer in that ship. Once I did, because I found that you wore overalls all the time, and you had to wash them a lot, and I found that if I went on the upper deck, there was a great blast of hot air came out of a funnel. I tied them to this, and they stood out horizontal and were dry in 10 minutes. And a young engineer officer came up to me and said, "Did you put your overalls by my funnel?" I said, "Yes, I did, sir. If you do that again, I'll have your balls for a necktie." And that was the end of my conversation with him.
And within the ship, was there a distinction between the Royal Naval crew and the Marines on board?
Oh, yes, a sort of... joke one. I mean, they were in those days, as I'm sure you know, they were always put next to the officers to protect the officers against the ordinary seamen. And there was always a wonderful contrast when you had divisions on the quarterdeck between Royal Marines, advance in column of fours and so on, and all this sort of bullshit, as we called it. And with a huge contrast, particularly with the stokers. The stokers really minded least about this kind of thing. And there was a great saying in my time, because we still drill in fours in those days, "Royal Marines will advance in column of fours," and the sailors in a ruddy great heap. There was a good deal of ribbing, but of course we all got on perfectly well with them.
And did you have an action station?
Yes, I was on action station on one of these HALA 4-inch Mark 16 guns. I can still remember.
And what would that entail?
Well, when you went to action stations, which we were at mostly when we were doing the Malta convoys, my job was to take a shell, push it into the thing like that, and then... the block came up and knocked your hand away like this, and it wasn't very pleasant because I hadn't got a glove, and it took a bit of skin off your fingers occasionally.
And would you have to load at a specific rate, or
put
it? Would you load the gun at a specific rate, or would it just be?
Well, as soon as you know, there was few of you there, and the thing was firing, and as you stood there ready, and when it had fired, you pushed it in again.